attachment of human beings has been studied long before the time of Freud. There is no doubt that a parent and baby bond is important and beautiful. How does one continue that bond of attachment throughout the child's life? What does attachment parenting look like? I'm Mary King, co-leader of Attachment Parenting International in San Diego County, and here to talk about attachment parenting. This is Parent Savers, episode 28.
Faster than a speeding toddler.
Sit still for just a minute.
Can soothe boo-boos with a gentle kiss.
Would you get down from there?
Able to clean poopy bottoms in a single swipe.
Oh, what did you eat?
Turning frazzled mommies and daddies into procreators of peace and harmony.
Ah, quit touching me.
It's Parent Savers, empowering new parents everywhere.
Welcome to Parent Savers, broadcasting from the Birth Education Center of San Diego. I am your host, Casey Wilt. Parent Savers is all about helping new parents from the baby years through the toddler years. So, download the free app, sign up for the free newsletter, like us on Facebook, and send us an email or call our hotline. This is your show. We want you to be involved. We have amazing experts at our fingertips, so shoot us a line and we'll get your questions answered. We also have a new option of joining our Parent Savers Club. It's where you can download the archive episodes and get exclusive content and so much more. I am a new parent myself. My son Carson is almost 23 months old. Soon I'm going to be saying two instead of months. And I'm joined by two new parents in the studio.
I'm Scott Killian, 35, certified financial planner, proud father of my son Alex. He is two, almost three.
And I'm John O'Reill. I'm a 38-year-old writer and I have three boys, five, three, and one.
Hi, Parent Savers. This is the Daddy Complex. I'm David Vienna, father of twin boys, and if my experience has taught me anything about parenting, it's that I know nothing about parenting. While we were potty training our boys, my wife had to go on a business trip. She was gone for 3 nights, and for each of those nights, I had to handle poop. To my boys' credit, one of those nights it was dog poop. When you're expecting a baby, people will joke with or warn you about how messy babies and toddlers are. No matter what you've heard or how detailed those stories are, it does not provide an accurate picture of just how much human feces you will be forced to touch. Firstly, newborn's poop is very fluid. This opens up a world of opportunities for fecal matter to find its way into places other than the diaper, especially if you experience what I dubbed the poo fountain. By the way, if you see your newborn making his or her poop face, don't rush over and change the diaper right away. The wee one might not be done, and your wall could end up looking like a Jackson Pollock painting. When your baby reaches toddlerhood, it gets more challenging. You'll experience daily poop accidents during potty training, and accidents don't just manifest as dirty undies. Poop will appear in hallways and on furniture and slip from pant legs at the most inopportune time. Not that there's really an opportune time for a turd to roll out from a pant leg. Even after your child is technically potty trained, you're not done. Once our boys knew how and when to use the potty, they still hadn't mastered the post-poop cleanup. I knew this was an issue, but really discovered how much of an issue one night when my son Boone climbed up on my lap and showed off a long brown smear on his leg. The worst part, however, it wasn't his smear. Let me preface that, like me, my boys like to watch TV in the nude. It seems that Wyatt left mid-show and deposited a monstrous bowel movement in the potty. He had trouble getting the toilet paper off the roll, so he just gave a perfunctory wipe with a shred of tissue and returned to the couch to cuddle with his nude brother. They both ended up with so many smears of poop on them, they looked like they were members of the world's smelliest Indian tribe, and yes, the couch suffered some collateral damage. If I haven't made it clear, let me reiterate. You will handle a soul-crippling amount of poop. There's no way around it. So invest in some gloves if you think it might help. It won't. And work on controlling your gag reflex. You can't. Often, when I was cleaning up a pile, I actually had to go to my happy place. I call it the Island of Purell. Check out more of my terrible advice at thedaddycomplex.com, the Huffington Post, or on Twitter at thedaddycomplex. You can also view episodes of Fighting with Babies, my puppet web series for parents, at thedaddycomplex.com/FWB. And be sure to keep listening to Parent Savers for more fatherly tips.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the
perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Today on Parent Savers, we have Mary King with Attachment Parenting International, and she's here to explain what attachment parenting is to us. So what does attachment parenting mean?
Attachment parenting, or AP, is a style of parenting that celebrates the many ways we can foster a deeper connection with our children. AP encourages parents to trust their hearts and their intuition, and not an externally imposed set of rules when it comes to nurturing their children.
Yeah, Mary, I just want to piggyback on what you're saying, because for attachment parenting for us, and we do practice it, it's very refreshing because it's not a very hard and fast process. I mean, right there, attachment parenting allows the parent to determine and use their gut how they should respond to certain things, as opposed to reading tons and tons of books and checking the box and am I doing this and what should I do now? What should I do now? You get to actually remove all of that and listen to yourself and listen to your partner and create the environment that you want to create. And for us, it's worked out wonderfully.
I love this so far. I've never heard of attachment parenting, but I think that I am attachment parenting. This sounds exactly like, you know, kind of what were the philosophies that we have.
Well, I can tell you a little bit about the 8 principles that we have in Attachment Parenting International. The first one is preparing for pregnancy, birth, and parenting. It's taking those 9 months to process the wonderful miracle taking place. Preparing for birth is considering what's important to you in the birth experience and educating yourselves on ways to achieve it. Preparing for parenthood is taking that lactation, breastfeeding support class, going to a local La Leche League meeting, perhaps lining up a lactation consultant to support you in breastfeeding. And gentlemen here, it really helps for the fathers to be involved and to educate and prepare themselves. This principle emphasizes baby bonding at birth and in the weeks thereafter. One of the most rewarding aspects has been sleeping in and honeymooning with my baby for a couple of weeks when each of them have been born. Principle 2 is feeding with love and respect. Like La Leche League, API strongly encourages and supports breastfeeding, which has a multitude of benefits. API recognizes that some mothers may bottle feed, and so we encourage breastfeeding behaviors when bottle feeding, holding the baby close, skin-to-skin contact, looking into the baby's eyes while feeding. Also encourages parents to feed when the baby communicates that he's hungry and not on a strict schedule. Principle 3 is responding with sensitivity. When I was a new mom, I was at one point completely overwhelmed by all the books. Then a friend said it's really quite easy. 1, respond when they cry. 2, you can't spoil before age due.
That's a good philosophy.
I want to just say on responding to your baby's cries, mm-hmm. that there's a real positive to that. It's how we then are able to develop a communication style with your baby. So as your baby cries and you try new things, are you hungry? Do you need a burp? And the baby responds and is calmed, that uplifts the mother, and then the baby's uplifted. And it's that ongoing dance of communication that we believe strengthens that bond between.
What about the child who always cries? My child had stomach issues and cried nonstop for his first month of life, and that tore me up. I mean, what do you do in that situation when you're responding to the cries, but they're not stopping? Is that still responding in love?
Oh, it is. It really is, because that baby knows that you're trying everything you can and that you're there with him.
Okay.
And working him through it. And I've known mothers who've spent hours bouncing on the ball or just holding him in the hands and walking around and going through everything you can, but recognizing that the most important thing is that you're there
being there. So what's the next principle?
Sure. Principle 4 is using nurturing touch. It encompasses all the wonderful ways we can be physically connected to our baby. For example, baby wearing with any of the wonderful baby carriers that are out now. Nurturing touch includes infant massage, hugs, kisses. Don't bother registering for the baby bathtub. You can simply hold your little one in your lap in the tub. Principle 5 is ensuring safe sleep physically and emotionally. Attachment parents believe very strongly in nighttime parenting and responding to their children's needs at night as well. Professor McKenna at Notre Dame has done multiple studies, and the studies really have shown how mothers and babies seem to be meant to sleep together. First off, of course, when a mother and a baby are nursing, they release relaxation hormones. Both mother and baby fall asleep together. Something I find extraordinarily beautiful is that when mother and baby are sleeping next to one another, if baby is too cold, mother's body will over warm up even more until baby's temperature comes to its status.
Interesting.
Baby's too hot, mother cools down until baby comes to the right temperature. In API, we talk about the benefits of co-sleeping. This may or may not include bed sharing depending on the family, but it does mean that the baby stays close in the room as his parents, or if that isn't the case, that he still gets the reassurance or food he needs at night.
And it's such a contrast from a lot of things that I hear. It seems to me a lot of parents that I talk to say how fast, you know, it's a race. You know, how fast can you get your kid, you know, either out of diapers or out of your bed or out of here? And it just seems to be exactly the opposite of what attachment parenting talks about.
My child only slept in our arms until he was like 6 months, and he slept with us at that time. But from 7 o'clock, till when we went to bed, he would be in our arms because the second we put him down, he would wake up. So he slept on the dryer for a while, in the car seat, and every other trick in the book, because remember, he's got tummy issues and cried a lot. We didn't try really hard to get him in the crib because that wasn't our point, and we didn't mind. But my mother, she was trying to get him in the crib. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And then one day she got him in the crib, and then he slept in the crib, and then he was fine in the crib. And now I look back and, you long for that time when your child was. And for 6 beautiful months, it's now a flip side. Instead of it being a burden at the time, it's now a beautiful thing that I wish, could have happened a little bit longer, or I just cherished, that time.
Absolutely. Harvey Karp calls it delicious. And I know the first time I woke up at 4 months and had my baby right next to me, I felt this deep sense of mother that I hadn't experienced. Principle 6, providing consistent and loving care. This principle encourages parents to find consistent and loving care for their baby and to be wary of some daycares that use caretaker roulette.
What's daycare roulette?
That would be a daycare where the caretakers constantly change.
Oh, got it.
And so instead of one caretaker that your child can hopefully create a positive and secure attachment with, it's someone new fairly consistently, and that your child is not able to create a communication style. And
so they can attach or bond with another person.
Exactly.
I know for us, when we were looking at daycares or providers, and the most important thing for us wasn't, are we going to get a list of everything they would do, but is our child going to feel loved when they're there? Is there a sense of love? And I think it's that sense of attachment.
Right, exactly. We share ideas of parents who do what they can to jigger their schedules to maximize time with their child. And some parents even are willing to spend through some savings in order to allow a parent to stay home with their child for the first years, when that's possible. Principle 7 is practicing positive discipline. I know we're going to discuss that a little later. Principle 8 is striving for balance in your personal and family life. How can we find a balance between a baby's needs and those of our spouses and ourselves? How do we relax and have fun?
Now, can you be an attachment parent and have other criteria? Like, my son is in the stroller, but we also have carriers. Or can you have certain aspects of this?
Oh, absolutely. In attachment parenting, we have found that parents take some of the principles, but maybe not all. I use a stroller, for example, and a carrier. So it's less, again, being strictly adhering to, for example, these principles, as it is listening to your inner heart and spirit, what your baby is telling you he or she needs, and being okay that it's okay to respond.
So are there any misconceptions about attachment parenting?
I'd say there are many. For example, this idea of co-sleeping or having your baby in your room with you. Oh, society believes you're never going to get that baby out of your room. He's going to be a high schooler, fighting for elbow space. I can say our two daughters, ages 3 and 6, sleep very happily now in their own bedrooms. Around 2 and a half, my oldest, we always made it a positive experience. It was going from something very good, which was this bonding, connected time, to something else positive. Oh my gosh, we're going to pick out your own bed at IKEA, and oh, here's the pretty quilt your cousin made for you, and oh, the baby's here. Aren't you so happy you don't wake up with the cries, and you have all this room in your bed? Going one way, for example, co-sleeping doesn't automatically mean that you've got a teenager in your bed.
Yeah.
And that you want to, again, organically let the child develop and transition and help them through that transition by emphasizing the positives. Do you know some other?
Wasn't there a magazine that came out recently
the Time article that it caused so much controversy, when the article was about attachment parenting, but the picture was a woman in this cute little outfit and everything with a three, almost 4-year-old standing on a stool, nursing upright, looking at the camera. I mean, I think that was one of the biggest outrages of Time magazine, but Time got their point across. They wanted to talk, people to talk, and they did.
Certainly there are those who have that impression, which is of course perpetuated by magazines that want to sell issues. I again, as an example, nurse each child to two. But again, if others want to nurse until three or four, consider that their personal prerogative. I don't think attachment parents ever really want to think a lot about what other people are doing. Mm-hmm. We're excited about what we're doing. We want to encourage other parents who feel that in their heart. I want to hold my baby, carry my baby, respond more than maybe society tells me I can. Listen to your heart. That's what we want to encourage others to do.
Yeah, one of the things is that when I talk to other parents that do not promote this style of parenting, it's clear to me that they believe that children are to be managed. You need to put them here. You need to, you know, make sure that they don't do this, that they don't do that. The attachment parents that I know primarily think of things in terms of abundance. You know, what can we do? What can we, you know, if there's something that needs to be corrected, it's more of like, you know, distraction and move to something else that's more appropriate, as opposed to like, you know, caging them in almost is what I feel.
So when we return, we'll look at what attachment parenting looks like with multiple children and tips to use positive discipline. We're back with Mary King, and she's talking to us about attachment parenting. So Mary, what does attachment parenting look like with multiple children?
I can't imagine having multiple children and not being an attachment parent. In fact, a lot of parents who choose strict scheduling in baby number one become attachment parents on baby two and babies thereafter.
Interesting. I would almost think that it would be a lot more work to do attachment parenting with more than one child.
You know, I guess it comes down to what aspects of attachment parenting you're doing. What I have found with new parents, parents of second children, they find that it's harder to ignore baby's cries with an older child in the house. They think, oh, do we really want our young child to witness this? What's this teaching the older child about empathy? Parents with second children find that strict scheduling, especially on sleep, goes out the window in light of an older child's trips to preschool, the doctor, and other activities. So they actually learn that the easiest thing is to go with the flow, being responsive to baby's needs. On a final note, of course, I don't know anyone with two or more who hasn't found baby carriers, at least one aspect of attachment parenting, to be a lifesaver. Baby carriers, of course, like a second set of arms. So your baby's firmly attached to you, and you have the other two to chase after, the older one.
So I guess you answer the question as well. How does it work in a busy lifestyle?
You know, many times as a young mom, I came across other mothers who would say, you know, I can't go to this activity. That's the baby's nap time. I found that strict scheduling could severely restrict a mom's schedule too. By breastfeeding and baby wearing, I've never felt restricted in going anywhere. When I want to go out, I don't spend a minute of time looking for formula or cleaning bottles. I grab the baby and go. If we're traveling, we aren't fiddling with cribs. He's in the bed with us. When we go out, he's in the sling. He might peek out for a while before he takes his snooze, but he's comfortable, happy, and calm.
And that's okay, having your child sleep on the go. It's not a, you know what they say, well, they should get interrupted sleep or any of that stuff. Your child still gets enough sleep?
Oh, he really does, because the body knows. And again, this goes back to the centuries of time. Babies, they learn how to sleep and they get the sleep they need. So it's actually that sense of security. He's with me. He knows it's safe and he can gently fall asleep.
Yeah, we absolutely do that too. I mean, in our life, and we are probably the epitome of busy parents. And during the weekends, we get everything done that we couldn't get done on the weekdays, including the four or five grocery stores that we go to on Saturday. It doesn't necessarily, you know, promote the sleep situation where he's at home, but we both go to the grocery stores. If Alex falls asleep, one of us stays in the car and he gets what he needs, and he knows that he can count on it. And that's worked really well for us.
But you work out of the home, so.
I do. We both do.
Does that make it, I mean, the attachment, so that when you are there, this sounds horrible, but you want to be there. Because at the end of the day, when my husband comes home, lots of times there's a handoff and I need some space to recoup and stuff. I could see myself, if I worked outside of the home, feeling like attachment parenting, jump right in there and do everything with it because I had that space. What do you guys think?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things is that we have, I mean, Alex is a part of just about everything that we do, whether it's, you know, Andrea does the cooking and I do a lot of the chores around the house, and he's part of it, and we like to have him part of it. It's not, we don't separate him from it. He enjoys doing the work. There it is kind of a dance. We do have times where, you know, each of us need to do our own things, and the other one of us does another activity with him, but he's part of everything that we do, whether it's you know, recreation or just part of life of having a home and a family.
Yeah, I can't even begin to count the number of weddings that our babies have been to in little wraps and carriers, just because they're young and I want to stay close for the nursing and I think they've each been to several weddings in baby carriers.
I think it's so funny that you mentioned the baby wearing, because we did. We have, you know, five or six different carriers. I have, you know, a couple of my favorites. Andrew has a couple of her favorites. And now Alex has his favorites, and he has babies that he takes care of. And Andrea, you know, puts a little sling around him, and he carries him, the baby around the house and does things. It's pretty awesome. It's pretty cool to see the mimicking and the mirroring that your kids do when you promote this type of parenting.
Hmm. How do you set boundaries with your child as they grow older? I am an extended breastfeeder. My son is almost two and he's still breastfed. I have rules around breastfeeding. I have rules around everything. Just like I have a mole on my chest right here, and my son, every time he nurses, he wants to put his finger on it. And but then sometimes he picks it and it hurts. So he's not allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. That stops. And I feel the same way about breastfeeding. If he hurts mommy, no, I'm not a martyr. Or if he wants to nurse in public. At this moment, we used to nurse in public and I have no problem with that as well. But at this time, we nurse at home before bedtime and stuff like that. So he'll ask for it. No, he'll go, oh, okay. And then he'll go off playing. I have other friends that every time their child feels insecure or in anything else, instead of doing something else to soothe them, or the child doesn't know how to soothe in a different way, they reach for the breast. So they're constantly always breastfeeding their child. Again, I have no problems with this, no qualms about it, whatever else. But how do you set boundaries in it?
Absolutely. It's a very broad subject.
I know.
You know, I think a lot of it, again, has to do with listening to your heart and your intuition and your child's needs. You describe the mothers who nurse, you know, for reassurance or for their child's, you know, various needs. I think if both are finding joy in that relationship, it's fine to continue that. Mm-hmm. And the child may naturally wean, or the mother decides, like I did with the go-sleeping, now it's time for me to gently guide and direct you. Hmm. Again, when my daughter was 2.5, I was pregnant with number 2 and just needed the space in the bed. Again, I think if it's working for both parent and baby or parent and child, just go with it. If one feels like it's time to transition, encourage that and support that and look for ways of doing so. On the broader context of positive discipline, I do believe very strongly in boundaries. That's our role as parents. And, you know, we have 30 years of wisdom and experience. We love them. We want what's best for them. And so setting those boundaries and those rules, of course, we know gives those children a sense of security. I think our children as well have security that our words are what we mean. And so if we have a child who's misbehaving or doing something that isn't the optimal behavior, positive discipline means, you know, obviously we're not going to use spanking, coercion, humiliation. There are other methods to use.
How would you do with kicking or hitting?
Oh, my younger one did that quite a bit with the older one. Or mm-hmm. She would hit. We'd practice gentle. We'd show her how to stroke her sister's arm or hug her. And we really found that by replacing the negative with something positive, that she actually started to move more towards the positive. Now, of course, there are times when a child will be defiant, okay, bouncing on the sofa, and you might remind them that it's not safe. You know, she needs to stop. And then she looks at you kind of with a scowl and then jumps again. Mm-hmm. I'd say plenty of attachment parents, ourselves included, do see that there's a place for consequences and time and, you know, time somewhere to consider the actions so that we don't make those same actions again. I think the most important thing, though, is consistency and that my word is what I mean. And you know what? You can have faith and confidence that I'm really looking out for your best interests.
One of the tricks that has really worked for us is the this or that. If you give a child a choice between this or that, you know, behavior or other things, they will choose one of those things and be happy to, or at least ours is, be happy to go with one of those choices. I was just having a conversation with somebody the other day about this idea of boundaries, and I was kind of thought of it in this terms. If I was in a helicopter and somebody dropped me off in the middle of the ocean and I couldn't see any land or anything, I didn't have anything except for my swimsuit on, I would be a lot less safe and secure than if somebody dropped me off 10 miles off the coast of Catalina, where I could see Catalina and swim towards it. And similar way, I think kids do that. They operate in that way and they'll swim towards the land. They'll operate on the fringes because they like the boundaries. They like the interaction there. And that's just what they'll do. And so it's, A book coined it pretty well by saying, practice kindness but firmness. And if you do those two things, you'll embody the attachment parenting principles.
When I find with the people that I know who practice attachment parenting, there's that guilt associated with it. So now at 2 years old, they want to start maybe weaning, or they want to start maybe, you know, doing certain things, but then there's that guilt. Oh, well, she's really insecure right now, so I need to offer my breast. Or she's asking for it, and she's bossy because now she's got an opinion. Or, you know, he's this way, and so I have to bend to that. So there's that guilt kind of complex associated with it. So what I'm hearing you say is attachment parenting isn't a lay down and take it type of parenting. You can be a good parent, you can practice attachment parenting, but you can also be firm and have boundaries, is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely.
I think if you do that, aren't you setting a precedent? If you were capitulating to your child, aren't you setting a precedent for lots of bad things down the road?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Well, this is great. This was a great conversation. Thank you so much to Mary King and Attachment Parenting International. If you want more information, go to today's show on our episodes page on our website or visit attachmentparenting.org.
Hi, my name is Debbie, and I'm calling from Fort Myers, Florida. And the reason I'm calling is because I have a 2-year-old son, and he seems a little bit behind when it comes to talking. After talking to my pediatrician, he told me that my son should know about 50 words, maybe more by now, and he knows 5 at the most, maybe. Is this something that I should be concerned about? I also have an older daughter, and she started speaking at a much earlier age, and I have heard that boys develop later in this regard than girls. So if there's any advice that you could give me, I would really appreciate it, and I just want to know if there could be a problem or not. Thanks a lot.
Hi, Debbie. It's Amy Goyle here, and I'd like to help you with your question. I get it. You've got your younger son that's 2 years old and is speaking a few words. You may be saying to yourself, and other moms might be saying to themselves, there's nothing wrong with my son other than that he's just a late talker. Everyone knows that boys are later than girls to mature anyways. They're late to talk, late to potty train, they can't sit still and focus until they're a bit older, etc., etc. I also understand your pediatrician. Now, speech is not my discipline to provide treatment for, but I can speak to you from a child development perspective. What I can tell you is that 5 words is minimal for a 2-year-old. 2-year-olds have a much bigger vocabulary of spoken words, and they're actually starting to combine them. They're able to say 2-word phrases like, my ball, or mommy's car, my doggy, red flower. So I can hope you can see why your pediatrician's concerned. I think it's worth talking to your pediatrician again and coming up with a plan for your son. Your pediatrician's likely going to send your son to see a speech therapist that can offer individualized treatment or monitoring if that's all your son needs. This way, if your son needs a little more help, then you already have your team waiting there for you. If your son takes off with his talking soon, then super. Easy peasy, he's right on track. I hope this helps you, Debbie. Thanks for calling in.
That wraps up today's episode. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for our expert about today's show or the topics we discussed, call our Parent Savers hotline at 619-866-4775 or send us an email through our website, parentsavers.com, or Facebook page, and we'll answer your question in an upcoming episode. Coming up next week, we're talking about traveling with your kids. Thanks for listening to Parent Savers, empowering new parents everywhere.
This has been a New Mommy Media production. The information and material contained in this episode are presented for educational purposes only. Statements and opinions expressed in this episode are not necessarily those of New Mommy Media and should not be considered facts. While such information and materials are believed to be accurate, it is not intended to replace or substitute for professional medical advice or care, and should not be used for diagnosing or treating healthcare problem or disease or prescribing any medication. If you have questions or concerns regarding your physical or mental health or the health of your baby, please seek assistance from a qualified healthcare provider.
Hey, mamas. Don't forget to check out Mighty Moms. It's our online community built for new moms just like you. Not only can you connect with other moms, but you can also join us backstage for special mom-only online events. And you'll also be notified when we're recording so you can join us as a special guest. Visit our website, newmommymedia.com, and click on the Mighty Moms banner. It's free. That's newmommymedia.com. See you there.